Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is a comedian, writer, director and producer. She was the first international student accepted into the Second City's Comedy Studies program and became head writer of Columbia University's long-running sketch group, Chowder. A prolific writer, often for topical shows such as Have I Got News For You, Mock the Week, The Now Show, The News Quiz, and Hello America on Quibi, she was selected for the BBC Comedy Writers' Room and held the BBC Radio Comedy Writers' Bursary from 2020 to 2021. Her horror comedy sketch show podcast, Seance Cast, co-created with Zoe Tomlin, was produced by the legendary Hattrick Productions and nominated for a BBC Audio Drama Award. She's performed stand-up in Edinburgh, London, New York City and Los Angeles, but has since moved more into directing. In 2018, she directed Olga Koch's Edinburgh Award-nominated show, Fight, which she later co-wrote as a BBC Radio 4 special and is currently adapting for television. And then again, in 2019, she directed Olga's five-star Edinburgh follow-up show, If Then, Cam Spence's multimedia extravaganza, The Sunshine Clinic, and Jenny Bede's musical, Jenny Bede, The Musical, which was one of the 25 best-reviewed shows of that year. Most recently, in 2020, she established and is head of Scripted Comedy 4, the brand new comedy production company, Daddy's Super Yacht, currently producing a 48-sketch output deal with broadcast award-winning website Pulped, 12 shorts for Channel 4, and a podcast for BBC Sounds. And yet, as you'll hear, for some reason, she still considers herself to be lazy. You'll also hear about what makes a great sketch, directing stand-up versus directing sketches, the connection between anthropology and comedy, the importance of having an enjoy-it-all mentality, and so much more. So, please welcome my guest for this week, Charlie Dinkin. Oh, Charlie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
We have, I didn't realise until a couple of days ago, a connection which I wasn't aware of, because I was talking to my good friend and co-writer, Elena Heinzen, about your career and Coalition Fangirls, your fantastic short film, which, for people who haven't seen it, is essentially a group of teenage girls who idolise Nick Clegg and David Cameron as they might One Direction or BTS, perhaps, now. And I've mentioned it to her, and she says, oh, that sounds like something Grace did. Turns out, your lead actress, Grace Stotesbury, her best friend and now roommate. So this was...
Aww, this is that's a lovely connection.
Isn't that nice? So this was fate that we were to talk.
It is. Isn't Grace is so good in it. She was phenomenal. Great in that film.
Phenomenal. It's such a good sketch, a good short film. How did it come about?
So... I should clarify that I made a film where teenage girls were in love with David Cameron and Nick Clegg when the coalition government was in power.
Yes. Very good point.
not recently. and actually, I saw it. So I made it with the Roundhouse, who are an amazing venue and also organisation that supports a huge variety of creative young people when I was in the age bracket where they were interested in me. Sadly, no longer. I think they ran a thing called the online film fund or something, and I'd applied the first year, and I got through to an interview, and then I didn't get it, and then I was like, I'm going to go back next year and figure out how to do this. So that was the idea I took in, and they gave me £250.
Wow.
And I don't even think I paid the cast anything. There were a lot of props. I think we blew it on props, but we had a lovely time. And actually, Rue Arahan Galieva, who's the other main girl in it, I just filmed something with her like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so that's like a little creative relationship that's gone on for 7 years with a gap. I haven't made anything else with her in the middle, but I just, she came and did some sketches for me recently, which was nice.
Oh, amazing. I thought there were sort of thousands involved in the UK comedy industry. Turns out it's 8 people. Just all
I think that is true. See the same people over and over again.
It does seem to be the way forward, is that you find a sort of good group, a good gang, and those people stay in contact as they go up together.
Yeah, I wish I'd known. Well, I wish I just kind of accepted that earlier, actually. Not even accepted. It's the best bit of it, is finding cool people who you like to work with and It's nice to work with lots of different people as well. I'm not like in a sketch group or in a double act or anything, but I think when you find people who you just think are cool and interesting, you should keep trying to make stuff with them. No one else cares what you're making. You might as well do it with your friends.
Yeah, you might as well enjoy it as it's happening. And then if anything happens with it, that's a lovely bonus.
Definitely, always. Nothing is better than making the thing. And I think people spend all their careers trying to get to a place where they can just make something with people they like. And it's like, you can do that tomorrow if you want. You can do that now.
Well, that's the secret. That's the ultimate. The Oprah Winfrey book from 20 years ago, The Secret. That was probably
the
end result. It's just have fun now. So looking broadly at sketches then, how would you describe what makes a good sketch or a great sketch? What does it need to have? What goes into it?
I think the nice thing about a sketch is that there can be loads of different kind of like, no, loads of different ingredients, but it doesn't have to do everything. Usually there's one bit of it that's the secret sauce. So you see like really good character actors doing really amazing characters, or there's something in the writing that's like a really funny concept, or even like there's something in the medium, like the sound design is good or the way it looks is good. And the better the sketch is, the more bits of those things it has, the more ingredients it has sometimes, although sometimes like simplicity is good as well. Mm-hmm. But I find like, For memorable sketches, what you're trying to find is a really funny and real observation, and then play that out in your style. Whether that's like pointing out that the world is absurd, or the character is absurd, or the situation is absurd, you're taking something that is based and grounded in reality, and then you're kind of showing the absurdity of that. I always think are the most memorable. Memorable and best sketches. What do you think?
I totally agree. And that it's the... one sketch I love is... I think you should leave now. Something like that. Is that... Did I get the right...
Yeah, questions? I don't think it has a now on the end. I think it's I think you should leave. Yeah.
That's the follow-up. That's the secret...
Yeah, it felt immediate for you. You were like, right now. Yeah.
And it does seem to be... Each sketch follows exactly that pattern of... it's quite a normal, mundane situation, and then it just builds and builds and builds.
Yeah, it really escalates. So I read an interview with, oh my gosh, I've completely blanked on his name. The main guy, Tim.
Yes, not
Tim.
Meadows?
Old Tim. Second City person. Anyway, I read an interview with him that said that every single sketch in that show is the same, basically. That is, it's a person who has committed a faux pas, and then they are covering the faux pas to the point of extremity. And that is actually almost like the unifying joke. Mm. And I think it's true in that series. It's always like a faux pas that could happen in the real world, and then it's escalated and escalated and escalated. And the cool thing about that show, I think, is that a lot of those people came out of Second City in Chicago. And at Second City, you are taught to write your sketches through improv, which is why they fit that structure quite nicely, which is you start with a situation and a character that's in the real world that has a normal beginning. And then with an improv scene, you'd like play it and play it and play it until it expanded out, which is, I think it really influences why those sketches feel like that.
Totally. And was it Second City or UCB, or what was the troupe that you were a part of, in addition to Chowder? Was there someone else?
Yeah. So I went to university in America, and then I did sketch comedy in this group, Chowder, at Columbia. I don't know if it exists anymore, but it was around for a long time when I was there. And then, so I did my study abroad, which was one semester at the Second City in Chicago. So I wasn't in the Second City, but I did a couple of months of classes there on like a little college program, and that's why I know how a Second City sketch works.
Sure. Well, you can make that. You don't need to add all that extra disclaimer in there that you were in Second City.
No, you do. It's too embarrassing. I see people a lot, and I'm still kind of in touch with like some of my teachers and people from there, and it is embarrassing when people claim that they were in the Second City, because it's a very big deal to be like in the second city, and so I was not that. Maybe I would have been had I stayed, but also I don't really think so. But no, I really was just taking some classes there, but I really loved it.
It was just a visa issue. That's all it was. Had you been able to
stay? Yeah, that's the only thing. Yeah. I'd have been on SNL now. I don't think I would have, but maybe. You never know.
Have you? Because I managed to catch a couple of shows at the Second City Toronto. Did you have chance to see them in different areas, or were you solely Chicago based?
Yeah. No, I've never been to Toronto. I once made it right before my visa did run out. I made it up to Niagara Falls and I looked across the river, but I couldn't leave the country and get back in. No, I haven't been there. I'm sure there are many differences and many similarities, but I know that there's like a big crossover of the kind of people who teach there. Mm-hmm. So I suspect it's kind of like a similar philosophy, which is again grounded in like writing through improv, really good characters, starting in real life, and then it's sort of like escalating into absurdity. Whereas like if you were a UCB person, I know the UCB is kind of maybe gone, everyone thinks the UCB is a bad place now, but the UCB's thing used to be that it would be like if you were writing a sketch there, if you were doing an improv scene there, it would be all about the like three escalations and then an out. So it'd be like you have a premise, you play it three times, it escalates in a very hard way these three times, and then you get out of the sketch and you go into the next thing. But I think Second City would be a bit more like meandering. But they're all, I mean, you can go kind of nuts doing the philosophy of these things, and I'm sure lots of people did, but they're all just different versions of the same idea, really, which is like do an observation and escalate that observation as long as it's funny, and when it's not funny, subvert it and stop doing it.
Sure. The what if and the yes and then...
Exactly. Exactly.
Fantastic. I did the same thing with Niagara Falls, incidentally, but the other way around. So I've never been to America, and so the closest I've got is seeing the, I'm sure lovely, but at a distance, slightly ropey casinos...
No, you were on the absolute good side, and everything I read to do in Niagara Falls was on that side. It is horrible, the American side.
It just seemed like it was almost like a Nevada desert with just two tower blocks.
Yeah, just like really ugly, bad casinos as well. Not like Vegas casinos, like the most depressing casino you've ever been in your life. I went on that Made of the Mist boat. That was good. But there was literally nothing else to do. And then I was reading about all these things you could do on the other side and like how cool Toronto is and things. And like really peering through the holes in the fence at the border, wishing I could go. But alas, one day.
I mean, you really missed out. I do remember when seeing were you the there? Other boats in the American ones and the Canadian ones. And it was almost like a sort of planes refueling, but can't quite touch and then move up.
When did you go? When did you go to Toronto?
I spent about 6 weeks travelling the coast.
Lovely!
Canada, a couple of days in Ottawa, because I'm a slight parliamentary nerd, and so that was fun.
Cool!
And then a lot of time in Toronto. I mean, I was dating a Canadian at the time, which is why.
So fine. A good reason. You're allowed to go even if you're not going out with someone, I've heard.
No one told me
that. A better
that.
Reason to be there.
Okay. Well, that bodes well for my next trip. So going back to Chowder and... Is it Barnard or Bernard? Is it...
Barnard. Well, Barnard. Actually, it's like... I think I always said it so weird because of my accent, but it's like Barnard, actually. It's like they throw the nerd away. Barnard. Barnard? Barnard.
Barnard.
Barnard. I'd say Barnard.
Barnard. Like
Barnard.
Castle.
Barnard. 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 Somewhere in between the two. It was a long time ago now.
You minimised all of a sudden. Oh. That was a shock, but you're back now. It's all good.
It's my party trick.
I was reading an interview you gave about how you'd never really considered going into comedy or being part of comedy before you got to Bernard, or however we're pronouncing it.
But yeah, Barnard, I think. Let's do that.
Barnard.
Well, I was a child and then I went to university and I guess I went to quite an academic school. I have quite academic parents. Literally, my dad did a PhD while I was a teenager, like late in life PhD. And I thought I was going to be a lawyer. Maybe I was being sort of pushed a bit towards doing a law degree. That's the sort of thing I was applying for. Mm-hmm. I liked English. I'd given up on drama at my school because it was all very serious. And they're always doing, I definitely was in like some horrible version of Oedipus and Antigone. And it was like, when I was like 13, it was so miserable, always doing stupid things in masks. Like, I was just desperate to be in a musical more than anything. And my school only did depressing plays. So I'd given up on drama, but I liked writing. And then, yeah, the reason I went to America, many privileged reasons I was able to go, but the main reason I went is that you don't ever have to pick a subject, really. You, like, major in a subject, but you do so much over 4 years as well. Mm-hmm. And that suited me. That suited me really well. And then my first year, I joined this like alternative theatre group that was really cool, actually, that just like would do these really wacky new writing plays. But one day I went to see my friend in Chowder, this sketch group, and I was like, oh, I've made a terrible decision. This looks like way more fun. So then I auditioned for them and I joined that. And it was fun. I had a great time.
You mentioned in the same interview that the journalist was paraphrasing what you were saying and mentioned that comedy is absolutely about politics or something along those lines.
Where is this interview from? Is it on the Columbia blog?
I've done my homework.
I'm actually amazed you found that.
I don't know how far back.
Oh my god! I literally was 21. I bet I've said some really stupid things in that.
I've edited a lot of it out, don't worry.
Sorry, what was your question?
I'll get the exact quote up so I'm not misquoting you again.
It might be better if you paraphrase.
Who adds that she sees comedy as absolutely political.
Oh god.
Do you still see it as absolutely political? And what did you mean by it being absolutely political?
I honestly couldn't tell you what I meant. I think it was like, do you mean what you say? And is it all just like silly frippery, or does it take a stance and does it mean something? And I think I think it can sort of be either. I think it is what you choose to say and what you put out in the world is important and does represent you. And like, I was talking about this the other day with some people I work with, but it's like, I want to talk about things that I find interesting and subject matter that's controversial, but I also always want to be like really, really sure what I'm saying. And I would never, even under, I think, some pressure from broadcasters and things, which is like a kind of career place I'm starting to be in, I would never want to put something out that I didn't think was the thing that I meant. Mm-hmm. But do I think comedy is like always about politics? No. And even if you are writing about politics, which I also sometimes do because I write a lot on topical shows and for people on things like Mock the Week and Have I Got News for You and the News Quiz and the Now Show, I think you can write for other people in those places in a way that doesn't necessarily reflect your politics, or walks maybe a blurrier or more interesting line through political subject matter.
Totally. I agree.
Good.
Talking about that in terms of the topicality, you were, of course, the one of the two staff writers at BBC Studios Audio, where you got to write on a whole bunch of topical... it was solely radio comedy shows, was it?
It's with the radio department. Yeah, so I just did for it. They didn't really have it. I think in the past people have written, again, like BBC Quickies was like a sketch strand that existed but doesn't exist anymore, but those kind of things. But yeah, when I was there, it was all mostly the News Quiz and the Now Show and News Jack was the set.
That seems like a job many would envy. What is something you learnt from it, and what is an understanding of comedy that you left with that you didn't have going in?
I think I learned a lot about, I learned a lot about how the industry functions and about how at least one part of the industry works, which is very interesting and has informed how I will move forward. So that's not so much about comedy, but it's like, if you want to work in it, you do have to understand how it functions. And then, yeah, I mean, I learned a huge amount. All I will say is this. I turned up in January of 2020, famous January, and everyone said to me, isn't this nice for you? Brexit's over, so it's going to be really good fun writing topical comedy now. And I don't know that I need to clarify what's happened over the last year, but I do think my mental health took a real nosedive trying to write joke after joke after joke about the most terrifying thing that I've ever lived through.
Sure.
But I also, I guess I learned from that that you can find different angles and different ways and interesting ways into things. Because week one, we were like, oh, man. Well, week one, we were like loads of jokes about washing your hands. And then 4 weeks in, we were like, there's nothing else to say about COVID. And then over the next 8 months, we had to find lots of different ways to talk about it and talk about the world and look at different things that people were doing and portions of society and reactions and places in the world and try and like deconstruct it in that way. So I think in that sense, I got better at taking the central premise and tearing it apart. I don't think I did an amazing job because I also, I guess, learned that if your mental place is not in, like, if your mental health is not in an amazing place, you are not equipped to really write that type of comedy.
Sure.
Or any, in my opinion, any type of comedy. I really think your health has to come first. And that kind of, like, idea that comedians are these sad old, they're so difficult and sad, and particularly comedy men so troubled. And, like, I definitely couldn't do that. When I don't feel good, I can't write anything.
Yes, that's, I think, hugely important for particularly aspiring writers and comedy writers to hear, is that the whole Tears of a Clown trope is not something that
you should
run towards. That's not a goal. That's something to run away
from. It doesn't
from.
Make anyone a better comedian. It's such a silly old myth. I don't even, do you think it is even a real myth that anyone hears anymore? It's been a while since I've been, like, truly dazzled and aspiring to do comedy. I like now and really know what the reality is. Do you think people still are like, well, if I'm sad, that makes me funnier?
I don't know. I think because it was so sort of exalted as a sort of like a received wisdom for so long, particularly in the 70s through sort of early 2000s. Particularly with American shows, particularly like the original casts of SNL, it does seem to sort of be like, oh, okay, well, if I'm a sort of more of a husk of a person than I was to begin with, I'm closer to pure art. And I don't
think I've done something that makes my comedy better, and I've given something of myself to do it. Nah, I just think it's, oh God, no, let's get away from that. I don't think it makes anyone any funnier, and certainly not if you're. Maybe if you're like your whole act is just you talking about how sad you are, then obviously you need to be even sadder to monetize that. But that's actually not really my business. Like, I really write quite observational or satirical or like character based stuff for other people. And like, if I'm writing for other people, most of the time, me being sad is not really helpful to the quality of the jokes they're telling.
No, and it goes right back to what you were saying earlier on in terms of the aim most people have in terms of creating comedy is to find a troupe of best friends and collaborators and have an amazing time writing together.
Yeah.
I think that's the image most have of writing is the everyone's throwing jokes around with scrunched up bits of paper, eating pizza at 3 a.m, that kind of collaborative atmosphere. And you don't get that if you're upset. You want the happiness to create. I mean, comedy is all about.
Yeah, you should pursue that. Exactly. And I do think everyone should pursue that. Maybe I'm a rubbish comedian. You know what I mean? Like, you got to counterbalance for that. But the thing is, I was thinking about this recently and I was like, I don't even mind if I'm bad. Like, I'm doing okay. Everyone might be thinking I'm absolutely terrible. And it's like just a pure accident that I managed to get any work. And it's like, I literally am fine with that. I hope that's true. I'd love to be bad, but just like absolutely plowing on and not noticing it. Good for me.
Yeah, and again, people who are objectively amazing thought that they were terrible for their entire careers. And so...
yeah, exactly. You can't know.
They weren't better off.
You can't know now. You can't. You'll only know at the end, and then it's too late. You should, like, really pursue having a good time as much as you can, I think.
I think that's perfect advice. And if there's one sentence worth of advice to take forward after the year and a half that we've had, that is it. That is it. switching from... Well, actually, this goes into another quote I found from you, which is how you particularly enjoyed Edinburgh Fringe in the first few years you went up there because you employed an enjoy-it-all mentality. And I love the idea of enjoy-it-all mentality. If you could explain a bit as to what you meant by that.
So I have such a complicated relationship with the Edinburgh Fringe, but I, in some ways, think I've made some quite good choices. So the one bad choice I've made around it is that I did not understand how the Fringe worked at any point when I was first going up there, which the first time I went, I was like 24, 25. And I didn't understand, like, that people did a full month and that meant you were in a catchment for being considered for the comedy awards, and then maybe people would come and see you and that would, like, lead to things. Like, I didn't really know that any of that stuff existed, and so I didn't care about it. So I just went for the first year I ever went, I went with a Downton Abbey parody improv group.
Of course.
Awful. Absolute nightmare. And I was a little baby the whole month, and I was just like a real pain to be around. And I was crucially breaking up with a boyfriend the whole time who was in that group. And then every year since has been, I basically always took 2 weeks. I've never gone up for more than 2 weeks because I see people going crazy for a whole month. And I don't want to go crazy for a whole month of my year. I really just wanted to do a bit of a show and have a nice time. But crucially, I've used the Edinburgh Fringe to either get together with or break up with a boyfriend every single year since I've been. So that for me is the overwhelming drama of my year. Either it's like the greatest year I've ever had because I'm like, I've met someone and I'm falling in love and isn't all this brilliant, or I'm like, I am the most complicated person ever and I'm breaking up with someone and at least I have my art. So that like absolutely usurps any comedy for me. It's the Edinburgh Fringe of me having a boyfriend or not festival in my mind. But
so it's more, it's Hinge, like, more Hinge than Fringe.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, very good. Very that actually is a very good slogan. Well done. But yeah, I think everyone, whether they want to lie to themselves and say they're really going for very serious career reasons, is going to the Edinburgh Fringe to have a good time, really. And if you go and you just are absolutely miserable for the entire time, I guess you better hope that you're, like, getting an agent and winning an award and selling your TV show off the back of it, because 99% of people aren't. And if you're not, it's like, oh, you're just paying £10,000 of credit card debt or something horrible like that to have a shitty time and get nothing out of it.
You might as well go on a cruise.
Literally. But I think the Edinburgh Fringe is, like, wonderful, amazing. What a fantastic place to go and to see loads of stuff. But also it's, like, not the myth that people think it is anymore in terms of, like, it being the make or break for your career. And how do I know that? Because I only have ever been for 2 weeks at a time, and I do work in comedy. I'm not a stand-up, but I just don't think people need to, like, treat it with this, like, seriousness and reverence that leads to such angst.
Good. Well, it's a good job they're not a sponsor of the podcast, but
sponsored by. Do you like it? Do you go?
I've been twice. Once in 2012 when I was however old I was in 2012, and I can't do the math now. 96 to,
you're so young,
16, something like that.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, and it was. I saw three shows, which were Alan Davis, Rod Gilbert, and Daniel Sloss before he was Daniel
Lovely.
Sloss.
And the White Man Special.
Exactly.
But good ones, good ones.
I appeared on stage with Daniel Sloss because I had. He compared my 16-year-old full facial hair to his late 20s mom.
Were you there with your parents, or were you there? Who were you there with?
I went with my mum. I went with my mum then.
Lovely.
And then, I know. And we went to the Edinburgh Book Fair too, and I met Gordon Brown and Michael Palin. It was quite a treat.
Truly the White Man Special.
And the Blue Peter presenters. It was a full bingo board. of
how nice
British celebrities. And then in 2019, I went again and launched this. I went up hoping to maybe get to talk to a couple of comedians and maybe had the idea of a podcast. And the first guest was Anna Dresden.
Lovely.
She was the only one to reply to my Instagram DM. And then aww. I went round saying to all the comedian shows I loved, would you come on to the show? And they all said yes.
Nice.
So I enjoyed it of the 2 times I went.
Lovely.
But I didn't spend
Well, that the last one presumably was the last time the Fringe happened.
A heck of a finale.
I can barely remember 2019.
It does feel like a couple of decades ago.
Yeah.
People were crammed in tiny black box rooms. Well, you were up there in 2019 with If Then, or directing If Then.
I did. I directed my very good friend, Olga Koch's show, the second show we did together. And it went very well. She did a great job.
How is the... what was it like to direct as opposed to... let's start with this one. Directing stand-up as opposed to directing sketches.
So directing stand-up is a very... Well, at least I don't know how other people do these things. I've not been directed as a stand-up and I've not seen anyone else do it. So in my mind, I invented how you direct stand-up.
The Dinkin method.
But the nice thing about the Dinkin method is I will only direct... it's an extremely intimate process directing a stand-up show from scratch. Mm-hmm. You're spending a lot of time with one person. They're going to be talking about themselves. They have to structure, you know, in this country, if you're going to Edinburgh and that's your like way that you're moving up, you're looking to do an hour of like structured narrative personal material, which means you talk about a 1,000 hours of stuff that doesn't go in the show and is like, is this funny? And often it's quite intimate stuff or like not funny stuff, or you got to get all the other stuff out the way. Except Olga, obviously she's just hilarious from minute one, everything perfectly in its place.
Of course.
So that's directing stand-up is a lot of listening to someone tell you what they would like the show to be like, and then watching them have a go at the show and then telling them what the difference is like mostly how you direct stand-up. How I and we in my little gang at Daddy Super Yacht, my company, direct sketches, which is the main place I'm directing sketches at the moment. How we do it is we have about 2 hours to film a 2-minute sketch. So we turn up, we set up the camera, everyone does their best go at it. We change one thing, we do a second take, and then that's the lot. So there's no reflecting on the meaning of life or... agonizing over what bits go in or don't go in. It's just hoping people turn up and have a go and stand on their mark and say their lines clearly. Mm. And if they do, maybe they'll stay in the edit.
And I suppose with stand-up, you can, like with other theatre, you can change it every night. If there's something that doesn't work, just bring in a change and see if that stays.
Completely. I loved it. I really do... I've probably sacrificed like a depth of expertise that I would have got by like focusing on one thing or like trying to be one thing. But I realized a couple of years ago, it's like, it doesn't excite me to just do one thing. And I'm not the best one at any of these things. There are people who are like absolutely incredible stand-ups and absolutely incredible actors and absolutely incredible directors. And I am not the best one at any of them. But what I really like to be doing is making comedy and solving problems in the context of comedy. It really like excites me. It gives me flow. Like, that is the thing I love to do. So like the solving a show and solving a stand-up set is like as exciting as doing a sketch, as exciting as making a radio show, as exciting as making a film to me. And I like the variety as well.
It's sure. And it does seem to relate closely to your presumed love of anthropology. You have an anthropology degree and then a master's in visual anthropology.
I do.
I've done my research. what about the study of people interests you?
I mean, I think the way I look at the world is completely determined by the way that anthropologists in, there's a, you know, that's a generalization, but how, the way you're taught to look at the world when you're training to be an anthropologist is very specific and quite simple. But again, it's like almost that comparative thing that I was saying a minute ago, like you're looking at someone's show, they've told you what they want their show to be like, and then you're finding the difference. And that really is like the central mechanism of anthropology, which is like, in very traditional anthropology, you'd be going to a place or a group of people, you'd be observing them, you'd be participating, you'd be listening to them, and then you'd be saying, where are the inconsistencies here, and what does it tell me about myself and the way that I live? And I think those two things have huge crossover with visual anthropology, which was the master's degree I did right after university. So that's like documentary filmmaking, but a very specific type of documentary filmmaking, like ethnographic film, which would be very I guess the way that ethnographers like really sneer at other documentary filmmakers is that they're like, people construct documentaries, they think of the narrative that they want to say, and then they just make what they're filming fit that. Whereas if you're an ethnographic filmmaker, you're meant to be observing the true reality and then preserving it in its simplest, purest form. And actually, while I was studying it, I really realized that isn't true. That distinction obviously isn't true. Whenever you are capturing or displaying anything, you're chopping it up and you're creating a narrative. And I think that did make me really good at like looking at raw material or looking at the possible options of how to approach something, and then thinking, what's the narrative, what's the lie that I can overlay over this, and then how can I persuade everyone that I'm completely right with this absolutely false evidence.
The Disney film where they're throwing lemmings off the cliff, that style. What urban legend can I create?
Completely.
Also, entirely right in terms of you need some structure to any filmmaking process. Otherwise, how do you know where to point the camera? If you are just observing in a
vacuum,
you need to have some sort of idea about who could give you a good story. Otherwise, in theory, you'd have to film everyone at every point and hope something came out of it.
Totally. And I think what you just said there is like, you'd approach it in a process, and I also do try to approach, I'm very invested in the idea of process, because I think one thing you can control is like having a reliable process to solve a problem. So like, you don't always know what the output is going to be, you're not always in the mood to write something, you don't always know what the end product's going to be, but if you can figure out a process whereby you reliably can make a sketch or write some stand-up or help someone else write some stand-up, then even if you turn up on day one of something and you think, oh my god, I'm out of my depth here, you know how to start putting one foot in front of the other foot and moving towards the thing you want to make. Mm-hmm. And I guess it gets rid of that like fear of the blank page. Mm-hmm. in a kind of more 3D way, multi-situational way. But yeah, if you start to know what your process is, you it's all just about applying that every time and then being flexible with that and learning and evolving that process as well. What a wanky thing to say.
Not at all. It goes right back to what you were saying about UCB versus Second City in terms of you need sort of 30 seconds of scene setting, then you need something to go wrong that will, the inciting incident, whatever, and then it builds and builds, and then you want the close, then it's a blackout, then it's the next sketch.
Absolutely. And that's your structure that you have to fall back on, but you don't have to do that. You can start doing it and you can follow it off into a crazier direction, but you just have this like toolkit that you can apply, and it gets everyone on the same page as well.
Yeah, and like with Key and Peele, they seem to, their sketches work well because they break the sort of last quarter of this.
Yeah.
And it goes into an entirely different and off unsettling place as a result.
Completely. And like those Second City and UCB structures, they are taught to you when you are first learning to do improv, right? Like that's how you can escalate people from being complete beginners into being someone who could like do a scene with a group of people. Mm-hmm. But then there is life after improv as well. There's like life after that bit of improv. I really did love improv, and I did it for a long time, and I think I was like never amazing at it, but I was always like okay at it. And it's like I spent a lot of years being very uncomfortable always doing it and being very falling back on the structure. And then every so often you just have a little bit of time where it feels like it's like writing itself and it's happening around you and it's just going so, so well. and it's sort of like pushing through the structure to get to that place. Mm-hmm. And then that's a real nice treat. But I try and apply that to everything. And I think I've just started to be at the beginning of being like, all right, I kind of know not the type of comedy I want to make, but I kind of know what my process is, and I kind of know the sort of thing I wouldn't say and the sort of thing I would say. And if I keep practicing and I just keep finding enough opportunities to practice, mm-hmm. and if I can get people to pay me to practice, that will help me hang on in there, then it can but evolve into something good and better, I guess.
Totally. Well, with a slight gear shift to go back to documentaries, because I want to bring up Celebrity Paul.
Thank you so much. I insist.
Of course, it was in the writer contract. For those uninitiated, who is Celebrity Paul, and how did you get to create such a project?
So, when I was doing my master's, you had to make a 20-minute film at the end, a 20-minute documentary film. And I had set up the worthiest project. I was so pleased with myself. I was going to go with a big international volunteering organization to Nigeria to look at a project that they were doing around teachers, and it was going to look at all like the ethics of international volunteering and like the colonial legacy. And I was so pleased with myself. And anyway, wow. The teacher I was going to stay with had to come home because her mama got ill, and so then no one would house me, and that was the end of that with like a week to go. It was absolutely all fine. But so I really had to find somewhere with 1 week, and my boyfriend at the time was like, he was a drama teacher, and he had been an extra in the summer holidays in that Martin Scorsese film Hugo.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, there are some people who are these like really careerist extras, and they really love it and are so passionate about it and so like taken with the magic of filmmaking. And there's this one guy that I met called Paul, who was just like this most bizarre character, and you should meet him. So I messaged Paul and I was like, Paul, can I make a film about you? He didn't ask me a single question about where I was from or why I wanted to do it. And then I got on a little train and I went to visit him, and I filmed him. I think I was meant to film him for like 2 weeks over a whole summer, but I ended up only going for like 4 or 5 days because it really was the most bizarre experience. But yeah, but so Paul is an extra. He's been an extra in a lot of things, but he calls himself Celebrity Paul, and kind of through like sheer force of will, he has turned himself into a bit of a local celebrity in Retford, where he lives. And he just really, I was just really interested in like the desire towards fame and the impulse towards fame, which I really don't think I have as a person, but I think a lot of our culture is like increasingly structured around it, you know, and we see all these reality shows, and I feel like whenever you see a lineup for a show that's like celebrity guests, increasingly, I just have no idea who any of these people are. Sure. Like, so they probably are famous to someone, but they're not big enough culture famous that everyone knows who they are.
Beyonce's never been on one.
Yeah, right. And yeah, I was just very interested in like what drives people to want to be famous. So he was like kind of my little case study. I don't think I got any answers though.
Didn't get any answers?
To like what it is that made him want to be famous. He did say once, he was like, I won't feel like my life was worth anything unless I'm sort of like writ large into the history books in that kind of like Lacanian big other way. But like, I don't know if I buy it. I think people want to be famous because they think it's going to be fun.
He did seem to have the attitude of he was taken by surprise and didn't particularly court fame. It was just thrust upon him.
Yeah, whereas he worked so hard to be famous. Please, what is he famous for? He was like going to, I actually went like nearly a year after I filmed it, I went to a sci-fi convention in Doncaster, and he was signing Harry Potter merch. And just to be clear, he is not in any Harry Potter film. He filmed as an extra on, I think, like the 6th or 7th one. I can't remember how many there were, but it was very upsetting to him that he was not in the edit.
Oh, he didn't make the
particularly
cut?
Because No, and he'd already told everyone that he was going to be in it, which is why he's doubled down. And, wow. Like, really, I think, sort of, no, he knows he's not in it, but he thinks it's enough that he was there.
That's incredible. And what I love is the pen round his neck that he...
Yeah, his celebrity pen. To sign Harry Potter books. It was, like, quite fascinating. I really, really did enjoy watching him. And he's quite, like, I hope you wouldn't think I was being rude, but, like, quite Brentian as a character.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
I think he was really happy with the film. He saw it, and I didn't set out to be horrible. I really did set out to create a portrait. I don't think it's like a mean portrait. I think it really captures him, and I think he was really happy with it. But yeah, I think the ethics of going around signing a Harry Potter book are, I mean, whatever. It's a victimless crime, I suppose.
Wherever that falls in the Nolan principles, I'm
quite sure. Yeah.
But yeah, well, he's having fun with it. He's having a nice time.
Yeah. I haven't caught up with him in a while. At some point, maybe I will. I don't know. It seemed like it was just such a specific time in my life. I know he was in a KFC advert about 2 years ago because he, like, changed his social media, which I sometimes come across, to be, like, KFC Paul or something, like, really capitalising on it.
Fantastic. There was one bit that we... I've spoken to you before about it, but I wanted to put it on record. There's a particular edit that you do in the film which stuck out to me, which was at one point you're interviewing his father and about him going, I had no idea, but I'm happy if he's happy, I'm happy, something along those lines. And there's a really loud, obnoxious phone call that happens next to him because the chap is in his later middle-aged years and they typically has the phone onto 1,000 decibels. And it cuts across, and normally that would be the take around. But you cut to a title card where you have the sound effect of a phone ringing, and then you cut to a newspaper article with the headline, My Phone Has Never Stopped Ringing, says celebrity.
Yeah.
And that's brilliant. How did that... was that an element that came from the visual anthropological side, or was that more sort of the comedy background that led to that?
I think that would be very comedy. I don't think that would be very ethnographic at all, actually, because you're putting two
sure.
disparate things together and trying to make a connection with them, which I think you probably would try and avoid doing as an ethnographer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really wanted to, you know, I read only like this year or something, read a David Mamet book on directing, and it was like, it's all film directing films. It's like, it's all in the edits. And I really do feel that. And like, I love editing. I don't get to do it enough, but like, I think you can, so much of the comedy of something is in timing, and editing is timing. And yeah, like bringing little things together. And also with that, it's like, you know, you can overlay anything onto stuff you made in the past. But I do think I was like trying to capture a little bit of like Paul's thinking process of thought. Because he really, really was selective about the information he would take away. So like we were sitting there with his dad, and his dad's saying that the short film he was in is rubbish, and being so rude about it. But he's just grinning away, and like I really don't think he hears that criticism. He just is like selectively pulling out the bits that
sure.
kind of form the image that he wants to see of himself in the world. And so for me, it's like, yeah, the takeaway of that is that in my fantasy of Paul, he's just thinking about how the phone never stopped ringing and how successful he was. He doesn't really mind that film wasn't good. And I think it's quite a nice way to live, actually. And in comedy also, it's like, yeah, you're kind of only as good as your last thing, and you might as well let it go if it's bad. Just hear the good bit and move on to the next thing. Why not?
Yeah, just write your own biography as you're living it. Pick the best bits.
Yeah.
You don't need to worry
Be
about
a little bit delusional if it helps you get through, as long as you're not hurting other people.
Absolutely. Well, returning to comedy and sketches where we began, Seance Cast has been a phenomenal hit. nominated for a BBC Audio Drama Award, I believe the only podcast sketch show of the category.
Yes, 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 yes. Very pleased with that. Actually didn't know what the audio drama awards were before we were nominated for one. But, and in general, not interested in the awards. But as soon as I was nominated, I was like, this is the most important thing that's ever happened to me.
Of course.
I'm going to tell everyone about this.
That's the healthier way to do it than be obsessed with them and then never win.
Nah, I never win an award. Never, ever, ever. I always am like second or third ever. But increasingly, I'm like, it does not matter if you don't win. Like, you just need to hang in there. Like, just get through. You don't need to be first.
Yeah, it's the whether you want the peaks and troughs existence or whether you want a sort of solid line through.
Yeah, no, I'm like such a naturally lazy person. I want to do the absolute minimum and just get through be the last person through when the door closes, not the first person on.
Well, in terms of the show itself, awards and glitterati aside, how did that come about? What was the motivating force between it? Because it is a horror comedy genre. And
yes.
I know you've mentioned how you believe that horror and comedy are at least cousins, if not closer related, in terms of their sensibilities. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think so. I wrote Seance Cast with Zoe Tomlin, mm-hmm. who is an excellent, excellent comedy writer. And I really think one of my best skills is spotting in other people when they're very, very good and then attaching myself to them for their project. And so I knew I'd done some topical writing stuff with her and I knew she was really good and she was a cool person to be around. And she's like nice and low key. And she also works in development. She does like entertainment development. And I increasingly think people who can do multiple things are more interesting to me because they kind of understand that sometimes you're writing to a brief and it's not about your own individual genius and all those kind of tiring things with people who think they're just doing their own projects and everyone's there as an accessory. Mm-hmm. I'm genuinely not thinking of any particular person, but I come across them. But so Zoe and I were both doing bits of topical stuff and we were really exhausted. And I asked her if she wanted to write some non-topical sketches with me. And we were just going to write one episode. And the original idea, I think at the beginning we called it like Weird, W-Y-R-D. And it was going to be, yeah, sort of comedy. I can't remember if the first thing was that we were going to do it. Obviously, we were two women, but then we opened it up to a lot of other women writing with us. But whether it was going to be like more like a women's podcast or more like a horror podcast. But Zoe is very much a sort of horror genre person, maybe more so than me. Mm-hmm. But I think I think what a long way of answering this question. I think she so naturally sits between those two genres. But when you start working between horror and comedy a little bit more, it's like, it just is structure again. It's like, it's a premise. It's, you play that premise down a road, you subvert that premise. The subversion is the thing that kind of gives you the shock or the laugh, but it's something kind of like a more guttural reaction to something that's happened than a rational reaction. Mm-hmm. So that's why they sit kind of near each other. But the reason it's horror is because Zoe is quite horror-y. Okay. And I wanted to do something that she would be really, really good at. And she was, and I really learned from her.
Oh, fantastic. And it's a tremendous show. Is it coming back for another season, series?
I hope so. I think we're trying to figure out what to do with it. It was so much work. So we did 10 episodes, 10 by 15. I'd never written a series of anything. Like, I work a lot in short form or in 1 hour stand-up shows, so that's like 2.5 hours of material even with other people writing for it. So it took about 6 months to write and record the whole thing. So it's finding 6 months again and then kind of working out who pays for it and how and why and when, because Hattrick paid for this whole season and paid all our writers and paid all our actors. We didn't want to ask anyone to do anything for free, so they have to want to do another season or something else with it. I think they own it now.
Sure. Well, hopefully they're listening to this.
I'll send it over.
they were.
But yeah, I'd like to. Like, what a joy to do your own little series and And for audio is so fun as well, because we were also trapped in our homes, but we could like go everywhere. And then in our series, with the opportunity to go everywhere, we were like, all of them are set in like the park or the swimming pool. They're like really the least interesting places.
It does seem that that podcasts, written comedy, seems to be the sort of the latest sort of nugget that's going to bloom. That's a mixed metaphor, but
I liked it.
Okay, but it does seem that because podcasts themselves, these kind of podcasts, sort of non-fiction ones, have been going for a while. Yes. But it seems like the scripted comedic ones, that feels like it's the next exciting thing that's just about to explode.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, there's some absolutely amazing scripted or semi-scripted podcasts. I'm thinking of like Beef and Dairy, which is all like masterminded by Ben Partridge, who is just like an extraordinary comedy writer. Mm. And it's sort of, the nice thing about it is it can kind of be your pet project. You can have control over it. I think the thing that will hold back scripted comedy in podcasts is, again, just like the time and the money, because you're not making any money for it, or you probably have almost no money to spend on it. And it takes a long time to do scripted comedy. But, you know, it is very, very extraordinary and difficult to get anything made anywhere. It's like almost impossible to get a show on television. It really, I know people kind of know that, but it's like, it is nearly impossible. It's like 10 people a year or something get to do it. No one gets to do it. So if you want to learn and try and do it for the fun of it, and also do it because you love it or because you want to get better at it, you have to find another place to do it. And audio is accessible and is manageable. We were very lucky that, because we work with Benjamin Sutton, who also I work with a lot in my little company. He is an incredible audio producer. But even if you don't have a friend or a producer who's an incredible audio producer, you really can learn how to use some software. It's not impossible.
Absolutely. And it does feel like it's the new version of the 8mm films that Edgar Wright grew up making around his garden and things like that.
Yeah, it's like, it can be fun and it can be playful. You just got to finish it. You got to finish the thing. And that was the nice thing about 15 minutes as well. It would never have occurred to me to do 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. I'd have been like, a show is 30 minutes.
Sure.
But Claire Broughton at Hattrick was like, 15 minutes, 10 by 15, do that. And it was like, oh, this is manageable. But also, you really have to pack a lot into 15 minutes if you want it to be very gag heavy, which I think audio comedy should be. That's the nice thing as well. It's like, you don't have to do visual jokes or work out if things are possible. You really can just make it joke, joke, joke. Yeah. That's all you have to do.
Totally. And a limitless production budget in terms of the imagination that goes alongside.
Absolutely.
And that brings us right up to date in terms of your most recent venture with Daddy Super Yacht.
Yes.
And it's right off the back, a 48 sketch deal. Phenomenal work.
Thank you very much.
My main question is, why is it called Daddy Super Yacht?
We were going to call it, our first idea for a name, we wanted to call it Naughty Boy, because I got a dog who's very naughty. But there's a game developer called like Naughty Dog who are really big and famous, so we couldn't do that. So it wasn't our first idea, but I don't know, it's just fun, isn't it? We're just all comedy. We're a comedy production company, and I think the name Daddy Super Yacht is funny, and I want people to know when they come and work with us that it's going to be fun and it's going to be funny.
Well, it certainly certainly secured that.
good, thank you.
Well, my final overall question is one that I ask a lot, but I'm very interested to see how different people answer it, which is just simply, either related to comedy or documentaries or whatever, why do we need stories?
What a big old question you're throwing in at the end there.
Just riff on that for 20 minutes.
Well, yeah, don't worry, I will. So, no, I think stories help us to understand our world and test out our thinking and empathize with other people. I think, like, much like you can approach a sketch in many different ways, like, you can write a story many different ways, and then your audience can interpret that story many different ways. And it gives you all these kind of touch points and places to test how you feel about something and learn something. And I think the stories we tell about ourselves are our existence, right? It's like we talked about like writing or rewriting your biography as you go along. It's like I have to update my CV all the time to try and get like bits of freelance work. And I always think, oh, how have I slightly like steered this ship a different way to make it feel like I'm a different sort of person for this thing in this job? And I've always thought maybe because I do so many different things, like it's a bit, my kind of like story about myself is a bit scattergun and doesn't make sense. But now I think like, oh, maybe at the end it'll make sense. And I don't really need to know as I go along. I'll just look back on it one day and be like, oh, okay. Like, I also get to experience the story of me now in the end. Yeah, I don't know. Did that make any sense at all?
It did. It's you want to be able to have your own highlight reel at the end. And
I do.
And if you can live the highlight reel as you're going, that's all to the good.
Completely.
Oh, well, wonderful. Charlie, thank you so much. How can people find you? What are your social media handles?
You can find me on the Twitter at Charlie Dinkin. I also have other, I am on Instagram. I can't remember what my handle is. It's not Charlie Dinkin, but if you search my name, you'll probably find me. I don't post on it very often. But yeah, follow me on Twitter. I'm addicted to Twitter. It's a problem. I'll probably delete it one day. But before then, you can follow me.
A limited edition.
Well,
Charlie, thank you so much. Seance Cast is available wherever podcasts are, and indeed, you can see Charlie live with 55 minutes of Charlie Dinkin at the Museum of Comedy on the 7th and 22nd of August.
You can please come. I need to pay the deposit on the theatre.
Charlie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.